Thunder, lightning, and tornadoes continue to pound the plains this year. But what does it mean when you're under a PDS tornado watch? And what's it like to be the forecaster who issues one? We'll talk with a lead warning forecaster at the Storm Prediction Center in Oklahoma today. And it was 64 years ago this week, Allied weather forecasters made what could be the biggest weather forecast in history, the D-Day invasion forecast of June 6, 1944. We'll talk with an expert on the forecast that may have won the war. From Tornado Alley to the beaches of Normandy, prepare for another edition of Jet Streaming from Minnesota Public Radio. Hi, everybody. I'm Minnesota Public Radio Chief Meteorologist Paul Huttner. NPR Morning Edition hostess with the mostest, Kathy Werzer, is here. U of M climate professor Dr. Mark Seeley in the house. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Paul.
And longtime National Weather Service met Craig Edwards, an NPR meteorologist, in the house today as well. Hi, Craig.
Good morning, Paul.
Well, weather and climate news on the front page again this week. It's at the top of the newscast. Kathy, the Senate debating the so-called cap and trade bill that would cut U.S. carbon emissions by two-thirds by mid-century. What do you know about this bill, and what do you think its chances of passing are?
Well, the future is murky, to say the least here, Paul. They began debate in the Senate on Tuesday, which would be yesterday, if you're listening to this on Wednesday. It is interesting because it's the first time a bill like this has gotten to the floor for a debate. And supporters, of course, as you know, say, as you mentioned, it could cut emissions, carbon emissions, the total U.S. global warming emissions by 66% by the year 2050. But opponents say that they are worried about the cost to the economy, the U.S. economy. And even if Congress approves this bill, the president says he will veto it. So we don't really know the future of this at this point.
So it doesn't look like it'll go this time around.
At least the debate is going
from the
on.
Political end. Yeah, then that's interesting. You know, Mark, Craig, we seem to understand the probabilities anyway of the science of climate change. But, you know, I wonder, and this is not certainly my area of expertise, I don't feel really qualified to talk about the policy or the politics of it. When it comes to understanding, the right action to take, are we a little behind the curve there? Do you think that's true? And I always wondered why we haven't created sort of a Manhattan Project when it comes to finding productive policy for action on climate change. What do you think, Mark?
Well, clearly, Paul, from the fourth assessment that came out last year from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, we have some knowledge gaps. Some argue that concentrating solely on the emissions scenarios and mitigating those is too narrow a view because we have a lot going on out there. We have continued societal vulnerability to weather extremes getting worse and worse and worse, and we have to deal with this at some time. The other facet that we have to deal with is we keep changing landscapes. We keep exploiting landscapes for their resources, be it water or minerals or whatever, and we alter the climate. We know we alter the climate regionally by doing that. So some argue that we need to think more broadly about this as well.
Craig, you know, we drove in here today in my little Honda Civic, and this is a week in which we saw GM come out and say they're making major changes in some of the plants they're closing for SUVs and trucks. They're cutting way back on production. They're only going to have one SUV and truck plant running, and 17 of the next 18 models they're coming out with are crossovers or cars. What's your take on the changes we're seeing?
My take is we're about 40 years behind. I'm old enough to remember the long lines at gas stations in the 70s when Jimmy Carter was president, formulating an energy policy that gets us off of gas, and we went 40 years with inactivity. And we know now that doing nothing does not solve a problem. I think there was another car manufacturer that's come out with a promotion that says we'll pay the gas prices at $2.99, which sends the totally wrong message of saying we're happy with the miles per gallon that cars are getting. We're just going to help subsidize your car gas because these are the cars we have made for you to drive. And so I think that sends a wrong message about the overall environmental issues of climate change and how we can lower our emissions. And it's just not a good sign. Going back to what Mark says, too, the use of the landscape, the use of the resources of water. I'm seeing stories about California now may be in dire straits with water again. So we have just got got to get more clued in on what's going on with the environment.
Well, it's going to be an interesting year, that's for sure. Climate change in the news and politics in this election year. We'll continue to keep an eye on it right here. One thing we're watching closely, again, severe weather, continuing to just rake the plains. We're under a moderate risk in the northern plains here tomorrow. And we're now well ahead of the 10-year average for tornado reports for the whole year, and it's only June. Of course, the actual number will drop a bit once the duplicate reports are blown out, but it's still a nasty year for tornadoes. And chances are you've been under or close to tornado watches this year. But have you ever wondered who issues them and what exactly is a PDS or a particularly dangerous situation tornado watch? And what does that all mean? Well, we wondered, and we want to take you inside the Storm Prediction Center to find out. Greg Carbon is the warning coordination meteorologist for the Storm Prediction Center, and he joins us today from Norman, Oklahoma. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Paul. Good morning.
Good morning. I know you have been a super busy guy this year, and you're busy again today. Let's start with the numbers. Where do we stand today with preliminary tornado reports, and what's the actual number likely to be once the duplicate reports are weeded out?
Well, that's a very good question. We stand at, it's over 1,200. I've been reluctant to update the count because that preliminary number is overly inflated.
Right.
And has been bandied about by the media as an actual figure. It's our own worst doing, really. We're trying to get the initial reports out so people understand what's going on, but there are often multiple reports for the same tornado, and especially true, we find out, in very busy times or outbreak situations. There will be as many as 15, 20 reports for a single tornado in the database. So we're kind of our own worst enemy in that we put these numbers out there, but that they've kind of been misused and misunderstood. And if we were to take our current figure around 12, and it might even be up to 1,500, I haven't updated it in the last few days, but again, that is a very inflated figure. We think we're probably running about 60% of that.
Okay.
So let's see. Let's say we're down around 850 to 900 in actuality, which is still a huge number for the year to date, and it would be, most likely a record-setting pace.
I'm wondering, as we're talking about numbers here, Greg, and this is Kathy Werzer, what about deaths from tornado fatalities this year? That seems to also be up.
Yes, and that's a number I'm a little more, it's unfortunate, but it's a number that I feel a little more confident in terms of accuracy. We have 111 officially. There may be 112 as of this morning with injury. I think an older woman passed away in Iowa, and I have to track down whether that was a direct fatality. So we're over 110 for the year to date. The last time we were at that number was back in 1998, so it's been over a decade. And it looks like, now, based on history, we should start to see a decline, hopefully, in the number of violent tornadoes as we go into the summer months. And, no one wants to see that number go higher.
Greg, I've wondered this, the 110 or so that we're at. We had one of those during the tornado here in Hugo, Minnesota.
That's right.
We had another woman that died in the cleanup this week from a heart attack. Are those counted, or is that aftermath death?
The Hugo event would be a direct fatality. The indirect fatality would be counted as an indirect, but it is not a number that would go into the count that we post for preliminary. Direct-related deaths.
Greg, Mark Seeley here. I wondered, in the introduction, this PDS was referred to, but I wondered, for some of our listeners, could you elaborate a little bit in terms of what really goes into that in your considerations?
Well, a lot is forecaster confidence. Essentially, the confidence that a forecaster has that the particular event will be, quite dangerous. And we try to relate this in a level in terms of probability, the probability that, we will see F2 or greater tornadoes or even stronger F3 to F5 tornadoes in a particular watch. These watches are not issued lightly. We do issue particularly dangerous situation watches almost by default in high-risk situations. So, you know, this level of threat should be an increasing understanding of what that threat is as we approach the event. And so a high-risk situation in an outlook means that there's a very, you know, there's a lot of forecaster confidence in significant weather occurring. And then when a watch is issued in those areas, it by default is a PDS watch in a high risk. Now, we've issued a lot of PDS watches this year in moderate risk areas, and essentially that's just saying the lead forecaster has a high level of concern in those areas, and it has been shown based on our verification work that those PDS watches verify with a significantly larger number of reports. I'm not going to say they're all going to be significant tornadoes, but there's a significantly larger number of severe weather reports in a PDS watch than there are in the other watches. Now, again, there are also significant tornadoes that occur in regular tornado watches, so nobody should take a regular tornado watch lightly. They're often, you know, there's a fine line there, and every watch is important. It's just that the PDS watches, we attempt to reserve those for those most dangerous situations.
This is Craig Edwards. One of the things I tried to overcome in my career with the Weather Service is getting people beyond the apathy, oh, just another watch. And I'm wondering if we've come so far with the technology and capabilities and communication. I'm trying to determine the value of a severe thunderstorm watch, which we used to say in the Weather Service, if you get a thunderstorm, that thunderstorm has potential to maybe produce some penny-size hail, maybe wind gust of 40, so you have what we call these garden variety things. Do you see a value in severe thunderstorm watches? And if we drop that, would just going to these tornado watches and particularly dangerous situation watches, do you think that would be a greater impact on the people really realizing that we mean business when we're talking severe weather for these particular events?
Well, Craig, that's an excellent question, and we could spend hours discussing the ramifications of changing policy, and we can talk about, you know, the cry wolf syndrome, and you know, as a forecaster, and I know that we walk a very fine line in between overwarning and getting the word out on important days. And this is a societal topic and a demographic topic. Depends on where you are in the country. Some parts of the country don't experience a lot of severe weather or thunderstorms. Some areas have thunderstorms, you know, almost every other day. You look at Florida, or, you know, the lightning threat in Florida alone. So we're not even talking hail wind there, but just the threat from lightning, which the SPC doesn't really take into account in its watches. So there are so many different angles on this issue and so many ways that we can discuss it. And there really aren't any easy answers to that.
Greg, we had Howie Bluestein on last week on the show. We know he's a folk person that's out doing the research, taking measurements in the field. How do the things that Howie and others do, these direct measurements that they take, how do they specifically factor into some of the new techniques that go into severe weather forecasting for you guys?
Well, there's some really fascinating things going on, and that's what's wonderful about the field of meteorology. If there are any listeners out there that are, you know, contemplating a career in science, there is just a tremendous opportunity in meteorology. It's broad and deep in terms of the research going on and the, you know, the things we need to be looking at. One of the neater ideas that's come along, and I think it's been revolutionary in forecasting in the last few years, is the idea of ensemble forecasting. Some of the field programs going on are still, you know, trying to understand why certain thunderstorms form tornadoes and others don't. A lot of that information may eventually be used in perhaps highly high-resolution radar or short-term modeling of the atmosphere, and that's where that field research is going. This spring here at the SPC and the National Severe Storms Laboratory, we have an ongoing experiment in high-resolution ensemble modeling. We're basically utilizing some of the fastest computers in the world spread out over various parts of the country to generate some of the guidance. And it's pretty remarkable when you start looking at model forecasts that look like actual radar, and that some of these forecasts verify, you know, 21-hour forecasts verifying quite well in some areas, not so well in others. And so we're trying to understand, you know, when can we believe a high-resolution forecast? and when do we have problems with the atmosphere as far as predictability?
Let's talk about a little bit about going back to the PDS tornado watch here, Greg. In my career as a broadcaster, I don't think I've ever issued something like this on the air. And if I did, I didn't know what I was doing in terms of, you know, what PDS meant. My question is, I understand that forecasters, the lead forecaster has to feel pretty confident in his or her ability that there's going to be some severe weather. What are the other criteria that go into a PDS watch?
Well, again, it's the idea that we'll verify with at least one strong to violent tornado in the watch, and most of our tornado watches we expect two tornadoes, but it's overwhelming the number of, when you look at the database and you look at the number of tornado reports we've received over the last, say, even the last few decades, couple of decades, the overwhelming number of tornadoes are relatively insignificant, F0, F1 in strength. They don't last very long. They touch down briefly. They may, you know, knock down a few trees or perhaps even take off a part of a roof on a house. But they're relatively small scale, short-lived, and weak. It's the big, dangerous F4, F5 tornadoes that are long track, sometimes fast-moving, especially in the cool season. Those are the ones that kill, and those are the ones that wreak havoc, as we've seen this spring in some areas. And those are the ones that we'd want to capture within those PDS watches and also within the moderate and high-risk areas, especially the high-risk areas. And to get to that level, that high-risk level, the PDS watch level, there has to be a very good signal in the data that's available to us that the day is dangerous and that has the potential to kill people.
Greg, I read in your discussion this morning that the possibility of long track tornadoes for tomorrow's risk area in the upper Midwest, parts of Iowa and Minnesota. What is the definition of a long track? I found one paper on the SPC website that says 100 miles. Is it that long?
Oh, I don't think it needs to be that long, and that's a very good question. And I don't have a. I'm going to tell you. I don't know if there is an answer to that. I would think that. You know, I would consider long if it's a significant tornado. If we're talking, F2 or greater strength, that I would consider anything over 5 miles relatively long track. And because again, if you look at the database, it's dominated overwhelmingly by these relatively weak, short-lived tornadoes. So a 5 to 10 mile track, in my mind, is if it's a strong to violent tornado, that's long enough. You don't want to. You certainly don't want to see one on the ground any longer than that, but they often do track up to 100 miles. We've seen a couple this, well, back in February, a 127-mile track on an F4 in Arkansas.
Wow. Well, Greg, we know you're a busy guy. We're going to let you run. Thank you so much for doing what you do and everybody at SPC to keep us all safe during severe weather.
Well, thank you, Paul. It was a pleasure, and we can do it again sometime, I'm sure.
June 6, 1944. Yeah, that was D-Day on the Normandy beaches. And a great weather forecast by the Allies found a window of weather just good enough for the invasion force to land. The German forecast, well, it called for more storms and no invasion, and they paid the price. Paul Gross has studied the D-Day weather forecasts over the years. He is a longtime meteorologist with WDIV-TV in Detroit since 1983. In TV terms, that we say he's the man in Detroit. That's what we say. He's also the man on D-Day weather, and he joins us today from Detroit. Hi, Paul.
Hi. How is everybody?
Good.
Good morning.
Doing great. Thank you. Let's talk a little bit about the state and the science of weather forecasting back in 1944. What was it, and what did the Allies have set up in terms of making a D-Day weather forecast?
Well, you know, in terms of what we have today, it's hard to imagine a day without all of these tools that we have. And, you know, as any meteorologist will tell you, it's nice to rely upon these computer models and the satellite images and the radar and the computer communications and things. They didn't have any of that back then. And so keep in mind that all you had to rely on, basically, were some upper air observations and some surface weather observations. And keep in mind that they were in England, And there's not a whole lot of weather observations west of England because you have the Atlantic Ocean. So they had a real, real challenge in trying to forecast the weather. But what the Allies did, and I've interviewed three of the D-Day invasion meteorologists, and they said to this day that it was a very dysfunctional process, that you would never do that way again. But the Allies set up three different weather forecast centers. There was the British Meteorological Office, there was the British Admiralty, that was the Navy, and then you had an American office. The code name was Wide Wing. And they were in three separate places, and all three groups of meteorologists would have to make a forecast each day. They would never meet in person. They would never get to see each other's maps and analysis, and then they would have to have a scrambled telephone conference call each day and try and work out an agreed-upon forecast. And you would never do it that way, ever, but that's the way it was set up.
Say, Paul, Mark Seely here, elaborating just a bit further about this competition, if you will, among these weather units. I'm aware from my reading, Steve Ambrose's book primarily, that the British had deployed some weather ships out in the Atlantic, notably at least one off Iceland, and that their data were used in assembling the forecast. Was that data shared across all three of these weather groups, or was it just restricted to the one group?
Well, that I don't know for sure. I would have to believe that at least the weather data that they were getting, I would have to believe that they were all getting the same weather data, but that's just, that makes common sense. And as we know, none of this made sense the way they set this up. So I'm not sure what the answer to that would be, but you would think that they were getting the same data. But I'm not sure about that. I really don't know.
Paul, what about the Germans? What did they do? Was their forecast different, and why, and how did it affect their preparations for the invasion?
Well, you have to kind of backtrack a little bit, because the invasion from the Allied perspective was originally set for June 5th. And then on a day where the weather wasn't all that bad, the meteorologists told the Allies, the commanders-in-chief, that the weather was going to be such that you could not do an invasion on June 5th. And in fact, the weather on the night of June 4th into June 5th was very, very stormy, windy, rainy. It was just horrible. Now, from the German perspective, the weather on the night of June 4th into June 5th was so bad that they canceled all air and sea reconnaissance over the English Channel. So they did not expect that the invasion could occur in that kind of weather, and the forecast for June 6th was very, very marginal. It was a very marginal weather forecast in terms of operations for an invasion. So the Germans, they were expecting a bad period of weather in general, and they did not really expect that an invasion could occur on that set of days. And as a result, most of the commanders were away on other business, and even Field Marshal Rommel himself, who was a brilliant military man, he was back in Berlin.
Yeah, this is Craig Edwards. In the early years with the Weather Service, I liked the idea of the collaborative consensus forecast, because back in the 70s, we didn't even have satellites in the Weather Service office. And what one of the strategies we used was forecasters go off to different areas, come back and collaborate, particularly with snowstorms. I was wondering if these forecasters that were doing this particularly tough forecasting job out there with lack of data had already built up some credibility in their forecasts, that the people that were going to make the decisions on the invasion were saying, you guys have been good to this point, we're going to believe you on this forecast.
Well, keep in mind, again, the decision makers were Eisenhower, you know, Montgomery and the others, and they are sitting in a room and they are having these two meteorologists coming in and giving them a consensus forecast. And the commanders, they were not aware, to the best of my knowledge, that some of the disagreements going on among the meteorologists. Now, I had the good fortune of getting Colonel Yates on the phone when I was researching the documentary I did on this subject, and he had a tremendous distrust of the media. He wouldn't even let me tape the conversation. However, he did speak to me for about 5 or 7 minutes, and one thing he told me is that the commanders had inherent trust in the meteorological information they were providing. He said that they were providing a joint, unified consensus message on the weather forecast, and the generals were accepting that. And so I don't believe the generals, the commanders-in-chief, and Eisenhower in particular, who made the final decision, I don't believe they had any sense to the disagreements among the forecasters. The only sense they had was the challenging nature of the forecast because of the changing weather patterns, rapidly changing weather patterns.
Paul, speaking of that, it from my reading, and again, I could be wrong on this, but Pedersen, the Norwegian meteorologist, was the one that saw or at least advocated for the intensifying high-pressure system that opened the window for the invasion. Did he have to argue that effectively among the other forecast units, or do you know how that transpired? Because I understand that it was a very critical point in detection of the intensifying high pressure that would open up that window.
Well, the key to the forecast was, and you already raised the point, was that naval ship that was out there near Iceland, and I think there was another one also out in the northern Atlantic there. But there was one ship in particular that suddenly came in with a higher pressure reading behind a cold front, and that gave the forecasters some confidence that there would be a narrow bubble of high pressure behind these fast-moving weather systems coming in that would create a narrow window of opportunity. Now, it was not going to be perfect, and it was marginal, but it would be enough to allow for an invasion, for operations on the 6th. There are many stories, and I interviewed, as I mentioned, some of the meteorologists, including Dr. Irvin Crick, and everybody has a different story as to who was right and who was wrong and who came up with this opinion and who came up with that one. And I don't know if we'll ever know the answer, but Sverre Pedersen was highly respected in meteorological circles. I wish I had the opportunity to have met him and interviewed him, but he has long since passed away. But he wrote a book on the subject, and I think a lot of people do believe and put some credence in what he wrote.
What was the weather like then on the beaches when they landed?
Well, you know, actually, you have to back up a little bit because everybody thinks of D-Day as when the troops hit the beaches. But D-Day actually was, first of all, started with the ships, even 4 or 5 days ahead of time, leaving ports in parts of the northern areas, northern England, northern UK, leaving and having to make a 3, 4, 5 day trek to the English Channel. And those ships were all tossed about because of some of the bad weather. But then on the night before D-Day, before the beach assault, paratroopers went in at midnight, and their job was they had a number of jobs, including to disrupt communications, cutting phone and telegraph lines and things like that. And a part of this story that a lot of people don't know is that 4 members of those paratroopers were weather observers with portable weather instruments, and they were to land with a radio man and actually radio the beach weather back to headquarters, and I was able to interview one of those men, and he said he lost his radio man and he was injured on the jump, and he just picked up a rifle from somebody, and he couldn't actually carry out his job until he found a radio man 3 days later. He became a soldier for 3 days. But basically, for the paratroopers, they needed moonlight and clear skies, and they had a lot of cloud cover and only partial moonlight. So some of those paratroopers were actually dropped 20 miles off their intended drop zone. So that hurt right there. Then at dawn, the bombers were to come in and to drop bombs and soften up the defenses, the Nazi defenses on the beach. But there was a lot of cloud cover then as well, and I interviewed Walter Cronkite, who was a journalist who flew aboard one of those bombing runs, and he said it was so cloudy they couldn't drop their bombs, and they had to then go back to England and land with a full belly of bombs. And so that's why the disaster on Omaha Beach occurred, the tremendous casualty losses there, because we couldn't soften up the defenses because the weather precluded the bombing, which was to take out some of those defenses on the cliffs. So that hurt the bombing part of D-Day. Then as far as the troops themselves, the weather, the water was very, very choppy. Some of these guys were so seasick that they could barely stand. But it was very marginal to get these guys to the beaches because the ships that would take the troops to the beaches, okay, those are called LSTs or landing ship tanks. What happened was these troops had to get off the troop ships onto the landing ship tanks, and then the landing ship tanks, those are those boats that you saw that would go into the beach, and you've seen the videos where
sure,
the door
yes.
opens and they all run out. Okay, to get onto those landing ship tanks, these guys would climb down cargo nets, okay? But because of the waves, these LSTs were bobbing up and down from end to end so high that, in fact, these guys would have to time their jump from the cargo net onto the LST, and if they timed it wrong, they might fall 10 feet. And some of these guys did. You know, they were carrying all this equipment. Some of these guys actually fell 10 feet into the LST and broke legs, you know, because the ship was pitching so highly from end to end in the waves.
Fascinating.
So it was a terrible, mar- marginal situation, but it was just barely enough to get the operation going.
Well, it's pretty amazing stuff, Paul, and you've given us a great context and perspective on the whole weather forecast for the D-Day invasion. Thanks for doing that with us and joining us today.
Oh, absolutely. It was fascinating to look back and talk about this. Certainly the greatest weather forecast in history.
By the way, where can we see the documentary?
The documentary, I know, is in the Museums of Television and Radio History in Chicago and New York. And it's also at the part of the official D-Day archive at the Dwight D. Eisenhower Library in Kansas. So those are probably the only places that you can go and see that.
Excellent. Well,
Paul Gross, thanks for giving us a little weather history today.
It was fascinating.
Well, that thunder sound means it's time for our weather website of the week. And Dr. Mark Seeley, you're on it today. What do you got?
Well, in line with our discussion of D-Day, Paul, I thought it might be interesting for our listeners to highlight a website that actually hosts a complete reconstruction of the weather of D-Day.
Get out.
Using
really?
Reanalysis with the modern computer systems,
wow.
Reanalysis of all the D-Day weather data.
And the Pedersen high pressure system, we presume.
Exactly. It's hosted by a site we haven't referred to before, the European Center for Medium Range Weather Forecasts in Reading, England. If you go or Google ECMWF, and once you're there, you simply go to the D-Day page, you'll find the complete reconstruction of the weather for the invasion. It's absolutely fascinating and has a lot of detailed graphics associated with it.
That's cool.
That's awesome.
I like that. Better than making a trip to the Eisenhower Museum.
Oh, well, that would be okay.
Well, that'd be
too.
Fun. But I mean, for those of us that can't make it to
well,
the
yeah,
Eisenhower.
Well, yeah, there's that too. Yeah.
And interesting too, Mark Angle, because the ECMWF, one of the models that we look at, the medium range forecast models that they put out, I like it particularly for cold Arctic outbreaks in the winter because I think it handles them very well.
I look at the Canadian
models. Yeah, right. We all have our favorites, just like those guys who
like
made the forecast.
Just like those guys, talk about this later.
That's right, revisiting
and I
history.
Wait for you guys to make up your minds, right. And then I just present the information.
Thank you, General Eisenhower.
Kathy, our listeners are paying attention. What do you got for us?
They are paying attention. I'm kind of wondering whether we should wait until next week to really go in depth on this. Just to tell you that we've received a lot of feedback about the weather warning sirens. We have a couple of lengthy comments from one in David in Hutchinson, Minnesota, the other one from Ben in Minneapolis, Minnesota, about the storm warning siren situation and who pays attention, who doesn't. And it's so long and involved. They're very interesting. I think we might want to wait till next week, perhaps.
Okay.
And talk about that.
All right. Well, you gave us a good tease, that's for sure.
Tease, that's
a good
tease.
Any little kernel that you can give us?
I think the weather for tomorrow is going to be a good tease for the program next week.
That's true, yeah. Any kernel? I think there seems to be, Ben from Minneapolis says he just finds people ignoring weather sirens, and he's just shocked at that. And then David from Hutchinson figures that, look, maybe the criteria to blow those warning sirens is outdated, and we should look at that. That's
a great topic for a whole show.
Maybe we can do that.
All right, good stuff, you guys. Thank you so much for the show this week.
Absolutely.
Thanks, thank you, Paul.
That's it for another edition of Jet Streaming this week. For weather geeks Werzer, Seeley, and Edwards, and producers P. Ray Rudolph, Jim Bickle, and Soundmeister Scooter Hibzinski, I'm Paul Huttner. Thanks for listening. Please tell your weather geek friends about us and keep your weather eye on the sky.